This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, the Expert Institute. The Expert Institute is your one-stop shop for all expert-related services to help you put your case together and to win your case, from finding the best experts for your case to doing opposition research on the other side's experts. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. By Hype Legal, a boutique digital marketing firm specifically for the high end of the law and the trial law bar, created by Micah and Tyler, two of the masterminds behind the high impact digital graphics, trial graphics firm, who launched their own digital marketing firm and are taking that same aesthetic sense and knowledge of the trial lawyer industry to digital marketing. Check them out at hypelegal.com. By Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software for trial lawyers. We use it in our firm. It does a great job managing all of our cases, handling all of the documents, generating forms, can pretty much do whatever you want it to do and makes the staff's life really easy. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. We're really thrilled this season to have two new sponsors, Steno. Steno is a court reporting service founded by a trial lawyer with a knowledge of what we as trial lawyers need from a court reporting service in order to succeed and win our cases. One of the great innovations of Steno is that if you choose, you can delay paying for the cost of court reporting until the end of the case. Their philosophy is that the cost of handling depositions and paying court reporters should not be an obstacle to trial lawyers winning their case. So you can put off paying for that until the end of the case with no added interest or no increased cost. Check them out at Steno, STNO.com. And finally, by Law Pods at LawPods, LawPods.com. Law Pods was founded by a trial lawyer named Robert Ingalls. And Robert left the practice of law to help other lawyers like us who wanted to launch and create their own podcasts. This podcast is produced by Robert and his team at Law Pods. They do an excellent job. So if you're a lawyer and interested in circulating your own ideas out there, starting your own podcast, I would suggest you call Robert or check out their services at their website, lawpods.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. This is episode one of season two. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
So Rahul, before we begin our first episode of season two, any thoughts, reflections on our first year doing this?
Well, Ben, first of all, thanks for making this happen. And I think that it was so fantastic. I've learned so much from every single guest we've had on. There's people that I've known for a while and I've gotten to learn more about them. And there's other people I got to meet for the first time and they taught me so much. I've actually started reading a whole lot more because most of these people are writing books and they're amazing books. So it's made me a better person even being a part of this. So I'm really excited about season two. How about you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we set off with a goal to do a podcast that focused on the intersection between personal growth and trial practice. So not just war stories about victories and bragging about big verdicts, but actually taking a hard look and being introspective and trying to do more of a deep dive. And I think we have accomplished that. Many of our guests have done that. It was really cool to see some of the reviews that came in on the show, other than I think your mom, who wrote a nice one. We just got one, someone wrote in saying, coming into year three of the pandemic, I realize I need this injection of inspiration and feeling of belonging to a community dedicated to the greater good more than ever. Looking forward to listening to the rest of the episodes, et cetera. So I feel like it's just been really nice for some people, particularly plaintiff's lawyers, because a lot of us tend to be practicing alone or in small firms, unlike the defense folks who are in larger practices, that we can find a community of like-minded people and learn from each other and support each other, particularly during these difficult times. So with that, we have a special treat today. We've never had so many guests on in a single show, and it remains to be seen how this will go. But it's really a thrill to have David Ball, Artemis Malakpour, Nick and Courtney Rowley. Courtney will be joining us momentarily. They are the authors of the forthcoming next edition of Damages, which is now called Damages Evolving, as I understand it. David and Artemis's original work, Damages, was a huge inspiration and kind of foundational work for me personally when I started trying cases. And I think for many years, I gave what I described as a David Ball opening. I think many lawyers across the country did that. So we're really excited to hear from you how things have evolved now in the next issue of Damages, and kind of turn it over to you to talk about that.
Let me jump in and just semi-correct one thing. It is not a next edition of Damages. It's its whole separate book. It goes with Damages 3, doesn't replace it, and it's not just an update to Damages 3. It is a whole different book, which is why it has a different title. We had a bit of a dilemma with Damages 3 because it came time that it needed some revisions, but more importantly, there was a whole bunch of stuff we wanted to add to it. But I didn't want a new edition because 90% of that book is still what people should be doing or people can profit from. And also, I know so many lawyers who filled the book with notes that they'd still need to have that book around. So I thought, well, doing something else. And then when the possibility of the Rowleys doing this with us, Artemis and I have been, even at first when we just very first heard about them, I remember we looked at each other and said, how the hell do those people do it? What are they doing? And so we set about to find out, and we found out, and it really blew us away. So we thought, well, that'll take us all a big step up. And I think that's happened with this book. I think, it's not, as I say, it is not just a new edition. Even the way I do editions is not until there really is a reason for a new edition, just because the publisher wants it. But it really is its whole new book with its whole new personality and a whole bunch of stuff that hasn't been any place. And there's a little section in the back of the revisions to Damages 3. So that's really what it is.
And I think also one of the things is, you know, David has these wonderful theories that, you know, ways of coming up with how to try cases, how to work through the litigation process. You know, my job is often to be the batter down of those ideas and how do we improve that? But I think one of the things I know talking with attorneys, working with attorneys over the years is that they've talked about, you know, there are all these theories and that's wonderful, but what about the application? How do we do that? So I think with Courtney and Nick, that was the wonderful piece, along with the tremendous ideas that they have. It's also they have the application, what is actually going on in the court. So we can advise, we can strategize, but they're on the front lines, just like y'all doing it. And so I think that was a valuable asset. And also one of the things that we talked about when we were doing this was we didn't want to have a book that just we all agreed. And, you know, it's just one way to do it. And so we wanted to make sure that we had the different ways available. And, you know, not every lawyer can try a case one way, like one theory. And you shouldn't also do it just with every case. You should learn all the different methods. And that's part of what this is, to try to get that. And then because David was really good with his assignments, he wrote his chapters early. The rest of us, not so much. And so once the pandemic began, it actually presented an opportunity for us to kind of pause. And even David said, you know, no, that's a good idea to look and see what is actually happening now with juries. And that's, I think, where the evolution kind of really, you know, just took off, was because that was the question everyone had. What are our jurors going to do? What are they going to be like after? And we said from the very beginning, we don't know yet. We cannot predict. Let us see. And that was part of this process. And that's why when people kept asking, when's the book coming out? When's the book coming out? Part of the process was to sit back, pause, watch, observe. Nick and Courtney are back in the courtroom. What's going on?
Welcome, Courtney.
Virginia's just joined us, thank the Lord.
I hear Artemis's accent. It's getting thicker the longer she's in.
I was talking to Joshua Carton about that the other day. He was like, I hear you say y'all a lot now. And I'm like, you know what? I've actually intentionally done that because I feel like, for me, it's such an inclusive word. It's such a, like, a comforting word, at least for the Southerners in us. And I think this world needs more inclusivity. So I've intentionally, even in emails, put y'all, because I want that kind of heartwarming. I mean it. Y'all, all of y'all.
So Nick and Courtney, why did you decide to join into this project?
They more than joined in. This is David. They more than joined in. They sort of put that idea. They sort of germinated the idea that that was the way to go. Because remember, it's not just how damages have evolved. It's what do we expect in the future, and how do you adjust stuff in the future between when it changes and when a new book can come out.
Well, for me, I mean, here are two of my superheroes that if I were to, you know, run into them somewhere in public, I'd want a photograph with them and an autograph that I can post on my wall. The ability to, the opportunity to write a book with them is like, okay, I've done it. I can retire now. I've done the most exciting thing in my career. It's been a huge honor because I've learned so much from David, so much from Artemis over the years. I mean, I back in the 90s, I was reading David Ball's stuff. And then, you know, as I progressed through David and Artemis and the Little Damages book, and I'd give David Ball openings, David Ball taught me how to try a case. And so it's such a big deal, such an honor and privilege to be able to write this book together with them.
So Artemis, you said that there is sometimes, and what a good part about this book is that there's not always alignment or agreement on concepts or theories. Can you give us an example of a place where all of you diverged, or some of you did?
Well, one of the examples is the David Ball opening. I think that that's one of the things that, you know, David admits himself, he has in the past been very strict of, you must, this is how you do not change a word. Every word is deliberate. Every section is deliberate. Do not change it.
Do it my way or go get a different job. That was the old David.
Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, you know, when I was going to different seminars and I'd see different ways, and, you know, because I'm from the Ball School of Learning. And so teaching seminar, and I saw someone do it differently, and I was like, huh, that actually worked for her. And so it was, and then I remember we did a seminar with Rick Friedman, where Rick, and wonderful Rick, gave a little very loving, I don't know if I would say lecture, or some little bit of like, oh, by the way, David, there are other ways of doing things. And then if you see what Courtney and Nick are doing, they don't do necessarily the traditional, you know, first of all, y'all have this mini opening situation going on in when you're in California, other states. So that was something that was different, but trying something. So maybe not necessarily going, here's the rule, and then here's the story of, you know, the alignment of that rule violation and from the defendant's perspective and stuff. Very effective. And, you know, and still, and David has in there the new alignment in the book, so you can see it. But Courtney and Nick have a different way sometimes of doing their openings. And that's part of.
Well, I have to say one of the major lessons I have learned from the rallies, even in my golden senior aged years, is look a little bit through other people's eyes, look at their conditions they're in, look at what, you know, and that makes it much easier for me to see that there are other ways people do things and that my contribution can often be how to help them do those other ways even better, rather than insist my way or, you know, go get another job. And I had to learn the same lesson decades ago when I was teaching theater. And it took a while, and I don't know why I didn't immediately apply that lesson to this, but I didn't. And I think that came largely from the influence of the Rowleys. I learned a great deal from you folks, and more than just applies to the profession that we're all in.
So there's mutual admiration going here, understandably so. So Nick and Courtney, when there's a moment where you see things differently than David and Artemis, how do you confront that, and how did you deal with that in drafting this book?
First, I was nervous about it because I didn't want to have my mentors and teachers say, you know, throw their hands up and say, hey, you know, I disagree, and let, you know, this whole project is now over. But what I learned is I got the opposite. They were receptive, and we'd have discussions and say, hey, it's okay to disagree. There are different viewpoints. And I think we agree on more than we disagree on. And what the things that might be looked at as disagreements, I don't think truly are. Because if you look at the foundation of what Courtney and I do and the way we present a case, or the way you'll present a case, Rahul, we go back to the basics. We're just weaving different things in. So, you know, if you look at it damages three, that's important. You've got to know that. And once you know that, then you can start, you know, weaving outside the lines and, you know, having the freedom to try other things. But you need your foundation first. And if it's not working, you're trying something new, or you've sequenced the opening or the witnesses in a different way, and it doesn't work, then go back to what we know works. So what the evolving book is about, Damages Evolving, is about taking the foundation and doing new things with it. Now that we've got this, now that there's something that all lawyers throughout the country have, which is a strong foundation to try their case on, and techniques that work, hands down, that work, that are the best out there. Now take that and let's evolve with it. Let's, you know, make it even better. That was our goal with this book.
Nick and Courtney, how does your approach to the opening differ from what we think of the classic David Ball opening, which is the rule up front and then the story of the case in present tense with the focus on the conduct of the defendant and so on and so forth after that? Is it different from that significantly, or
it depends? What I would say is it's not very different. It's the content and the way we, let's say if it's a damages only case, right? Or you've bifurcated the case and you've won liability and now you're going into damages, then you're not going to start with the rule necessarily if the rule's already been established or if the jurors have already been instructed. The case we most recently tried, we couldn't get up there and talk about all the bad things that the defendants did, which resulted in a lower verdict. You know, in the prior trial, we had done a lot of that. We weren't allowed to in this third trial. So, yeah, and you know, if we have a case with, you know, a really bad catastrophic injury and some really, you know, horrible photographs of the scene, we might just put those up first and say, you know, just bam, there's a picture of wreckage. Say that's what happened. And then click to the next photograph, which, you know, shows the consequences. You know, maybe it's a tombstone. Maybe it's a picture of, you know, the person who passed away or the person who's seriously hurt and now in a wheelchair. say, that's the consequence. Let me tell you why. And then we go to the rule. So we're just, you know, putting other pieces in at different points, but we're still following the same structure that we learned 20 years ago.
There does seem to be a movement towards putting the bad outcome of some photographs to draw the jury in first. And Lloyd Bell talked about that as the monster running through the maze at the beginning of Stranger Things. But like Mark Lanier in his Vioxx trial started out with the disappearing image of the person who died. But David, that wasn't part of the classic opening. I think the thought was you don't want to focus on the plaintiff because then people...
We were trying to reverse what was a very dangerous trend.
Yes.
And that was every single time you heard an opening, they were starting with all these terrible things. And that was in the middle of the worst part of tort reform. And so the first thing people are thinking, jurors are thinking is, oh, here goes another damn trial lawyer trying to get money out of us. So there was a rather, talk about damages evolving. Still, I think in most cases, you want to start with what the defendant did. I still think that's an important focus. However, it's not as monolithically necessary. I think it was then because of that incoming bias, because the insurance company and the corporations had done such an amazing job at poisoning the entire jury pool.
I think that is such an important point, though, what David's saying. He's talking about context and cultural context, right? As trial lawyers, that's the essence of our job, is to have the pulse on what's happening culturally, not in the media. You know, I'm sure, Rahul, what you're seeing, that we're seeing, is jurors are very different right now than what America is being portrayed on the media. I'm finding very empathetic, tuned in, emotionally available jurors in the last four or five trials we've been in. But David's talking about cultural context. And I think that's something that is what makes me so excited about David and Artemis, is their work is always tied back to their research with actual human beings and focus groups and jurors. And so a lot of what we do has to also change, not just with the culture, but maybe a little bit ahead of the culture.
What David just said is still true to this day. And the reason why we are not looked at the way that we were when tort reform was going rampant in the 90s, and even late 80s and 90s, is because we've changed the way that we do things. So the work that David and Artemis have done transformed the way that lawyers present cases to juries, and it's changed the credibility of trial lawyers in our courts and in our communities. I don't think that anything changes. What was going on back, you know, in the 90s, and the way I learned how to try a case before I got David Ball's first little book, was get up and I'd see lawyers and they'd let me tell you what happened, you know, to Miss Ramirez. Miss Ramirez was a mother, and going on and on and on and on, you know, and here's what happened to her, and here are the photos, and here's this, to get the jurors all fired up and inflamed and sympathetic for Miss Ramirez before they ever talked about what the defendant did. And the defense lawyer would get up and say, well, you know, that's really awful, but there's a difference between being responsible for something, being negligent, and this was a really unfortunate event, but my client isn't responsible for all that. And then that twists it around. So when you're front loading your case, talking about, you know, the damages that your client or clients have suffered and just gilding that lily, you're going to lose credibility with the jury because people are going to tune out. And it's shocking. People don't want to see that. They want to understand why. So nothing changes. If we put something up and we show a picture of the wreckage and we say this is the consequence, it's quick. And then we get right back into what you'll learn, you know, if you've read The Alignment in David Ball 3 and go back to the other books, which is start with the rule. Here's what happened. Here's what the defendant did. And here's why this lawsuit is being brought. And then go back in, you know, to talking about what the consequences were.
And there are examples of when you accomplish the same thing and yet you've started with damages first. That's possible. There are some kinds of damages that, as you tell people, here's the wreck, here's what happened, here's the hospital mess, in the damages to the person is inherent the story that someone had to do something really awful to have made this happen. So you're not just saying a bad thing happened, give us money, but implicitly it's very clear in the nature of the damage that someone did something wrong. You know, when the Challenger blew up, no one thought it was just an accident. It took people forever to figure out what the hell had happened, but nobody thought it was just an accident. They knew somewhere, somehow, somebody had had to do something wrong. Maybe that's a bad example because it wasn't quite that clear at the moment. But there are, if the damages are that way, then. And the other thing I need to look at is some really fine lawyers do the opposite and they do fine. However, that doesn't mean it's going to work for 90% of the lawyers out there. And that's the,
right.
Something that works for Jerry Spence is not necessarily going to work for 95% of the other lawyers in America. And that's really what, you know, that's what we're writing for. What good is it to you to tell you how Mozart composed? You ain't ever going to compose like Mozart. You need to compose like an ordinary, normal, average, above average, the person that we really have there. With all due respect, I don't mean that everybody listening is not, in fact, the best. Yeah, you're all the best. So what does that mean?
Well, I think going back to Nick's point also of, and it is within the context of the case that you're presenting. So even if you are able to do a Jerry Spence method, maybe on this case, it's something different. But I also want to go back to Courtney's point about jurors and what we're seeing, both them in trial, what I'm seeing in focus groups and that idea of empathy and what's different than what's on media or the social media. And I think that's one of the things that we actually had a conversation about this during the book writing, that, you know, jurors, there's so much division. And when we were looking at COVID and do we talk about COVID, do we not, and jury selection, all this stuff, one of the things that we talked about is that trial, and even in my focus group sessions, it's an opportunity for jurors to kind of take a break from the fighting. It's kind of this salvation, it's this sanctuary kind of thing of so much disagreement out there. Can we all just kind of separate ourselves from that and come together as people, as a community, and work together on this thing in front of us, tackling this question, these problems in front of us, this issue in front of us, and try to come on the same page, get on the same page with that. And hopefully what you are trying to do is get them on your page. And that's part of also how you need to approach the jurors. You know, if you go in thinking that they're the enemy and this is so crucial and, you know, their brutal honesty approach that Courtney and Nick talk about all the time is that if you go in there looking at them as the enemy and saying, oh, I'm going to get these folks who are going to be awful for this case and I'm going to try to pick out the worst people and all that stuff, you're coming in with a negative mindset and you're already feeding into what they believe lawyers are, what this lawsuit is going to be. And you really want to just embrace them and put them, and you actually put them in this warm setting of cooperation. And we're not going to waste your time. And we're going to give you the information, only the information that you need, and welcoming. And what I do in my focus groups is I start out by telling folks, you know what, we all have different opinions. We're going to, at some point, we're going to start discussing this case, and you're all coming from different perspectives. And, you know, back in the day, I would tell folks that, you know, you're going to be amazed that you hear the same thing, but think very differently. I don't need to tell you all that now, because that's certainly what we see often now in the world. And so I want you to make sure that this place where we are now, we're all respectful of that, and we appreciate where people are coming from and those differences. And frankly, it'd be a very boring world if we all saw things the same. And so I allow them that we're going to be different and y'all are going to have some disagreements, but eventually we're all on the same team and we're all working for the same kind of cause. And I think that's that unity. So I didn't want Courtney's point to be missed or just kind of overlooked the idea of what we're seeing out there. And that's part of evolution. That's part of where we are and how we hope people approach cases coming in.
And that kind of flies in the face of a 50s brat like me, that everything becomes provocational and everything becomes hostile and everything becomes adversarial. Hey, kid, quit leaning on my car was the get off my car. That's the catchphrase of the 50s brat. The aggressiveness, I've never liked the phrase, and I have really come to dislike it lately, of the trial lawyer as warrior, because I think that sends the wrong message. At the time, it was very useful. But I think now we're not warriors. I'm not a trial lawyer. I'm a consultant, but trial lawyers are not warriors. I think the most effective ones now are unifiers. And there's a huge difference there. And that's what one of the major lessons that I had to learn is that within all the methodology, unification of the jury into a working group with a mission, isolate. It's the only group left in the world, in America, that operates independently on its own and cooperatively without money interests and other interests reaching in to influence, to sway how it's going to come out. They're an independent, completely independent in most cases, in most ways. And that's a very different group of people. And Artemis is dead right. People on both sides of this huge divide we're in right now, people really crave that. They would like something less warring with each other than even families, or maybe than especially families.
Is this different? Are you saying that the trend is away from the so-called polarizing the case, or what we're doing now is trial lawyers presenting the defense as being the agents of polarization and we're the unifiers, but we're still polarizing it in that we're unifiers and they're polarizers. So therefore it's still polarized in that way.
Polarizing between us and the forces that are fighting justice, fighting against justice. Yes. But it's the jury makes perfect sense. The jury as a unified force. Look, I have some very conservative friends. I'm very liberal. If we sit down in a room with no outside considerations, we can come up with pretty good hypothetical solutions for almost every political problem we face, except maybe abortion, because that's so firmly moral and it's hard to. But everything else, take out the lobbying, take out the politics. Solutions are sitting right there. Well, that's not going to happen in the big world for a long time, if ever. But in juries, it can happen. People can get together and do something. So our polarization is in the face of that we're polarized against something. It's like if Mars came down and attacked us, the world would be one big unified place like America was right after 9/11.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do. The polarization had nothing to do. It was not an intra-polarization. It was inter-polarization.
Unified polarization.
Yes.
That's what we're doing. Without our jury trial.
That sounds like another book.
Jury to be unified against the evil darkness of the frivolous defenses that, you know, we're standing up against.
Which is exactly what Friedman's book does.
Yeah.
It gives something to coalesce. Think coalesce.
David, when I started doing your opening a decade ago or so, there are long chapters on the damages claims that and the arguments you put in. I remember you speaking once and telling people that jurors think the case is about whatever you tell them it's about. So if you spend time on damages and ratchet up the significance of it, then they're going to think those are significant. But I know there's been a trend in recent years away from long openings, and there's in fact a trend towards speedy trials altogether. Where do you guys come down on that? Is that an evolution, do you think, towards lower attention spans and shorter presentations? Or do you stick to you should put in all of the important elements of damages?
Put all the important elements in without taking a lot of time. I don't think the two are the same question.
And I wouldn't say shorten your opening statements or shorten your closing arguments or shorten your voir dire. I would say shorten the time you have witnesses on the stand. Move quick, and the jurors are going to see the presentation of evidence is being very efficient. And then use the time. I tell judges, give me the time to pick a good jury. a jury that's fair and neutral to both sides. This is the most important part of the trial. And yes, I don't want to be limited to 30 minutes for opening. I need an hour, or I need an hour and 15 minutes. And if I'm able to do that, Your Honor, and show the jurors the path of where the evidence is going to lead us, then I'm going to be able to get through the evidence much quicker. And if at any point during my opening statement, I'm not moving along, then stop me, pull me aside and let me know, because the judge is going to be engaged when I'm doing the opening. And then you put the witnesses on, boom, you move through it. Then in closing, you spend the time to put it all together. So you can have a trial that took 4 hours to put on, and you have an hour opening and an hour and 15 minutes with your closing and rebuttal.
And I think the important thing is tightening the information, making sure that the information that you give them, I always ask attorneys, what do you want jurors, when you're done with, whether it's the opening, the closing, this witness, what do you want them to take from that? And then what's the information that we need to give them to get them to that point? And also anticipating what's the defense going to say, so you can get on top of that, deal with it on your end of it rather than defensively on, you know, redirect. But it's every, David says, what is it? Every information, piece of information that you give comes with it with a weight, with a risk. And, you know, that's part of doing the focus groups is seeing that you say, here's an information dump. All the wonderful things. Look at how much time I spent. Look how much information I gathered. Look at how much I know. And I'm going to give it to you all jurors to see, pat my back. Look how much I did for you, how much work I did. And then they take information and something that you thought was helpful to you, you never really considered how it could hurt you. So they use a fact that you either didn't emphasize, maybe even only said once in a, you know, dump of a whole bunch of other stuff that you wanted them to focus on, and they run with that. And it was information that you hoped would only go to make this point. There were 5,000 other points that it could have made, and they chose those other 5,000 dangerous points that it made. Did you really need that information? And that's, I think, the conciseness of it.
Boy, we've seen examples where cases have blown up in people's faces because of exactly that. A fact they thought was strong for them, the jurors just took a different way that they hadn't thought of, the plaintiff's team hadn't thought of. And all of a sudden, you're fighting yourself in trial. You've de-unified yourself.
We just did it, David. Yeah. And it wasn't us. It wasn't me.
So, right. You can claim it was others.
Son of a bitch, it wasn't my fault this time.
I'll take responsibility.
It was always Nick's fault in so many ways.
All and so always many things. And ever.
I know. I need a sweatshirt. But our client out of his mouth in the middle of a sentence, yes. This was not the entire sentence, blurted something to the effect of, I've always put my job before my family.
And it wasn't and that even was buried in an question.
Nick, shush. And it wasn't even in response to the question. Anyway, but so this guy volunteers this and it's buried in a lot of other information. And strangely, what you do, you know, wishful thinking, right, Rahul, when shit goes sideways and you feel that ping in your side, you're like, maybe nobody else felt that. Maybe nobody else heard that. And then,
except you see the entire jury staring at you with laser beams.
And, oh, yeah.
As you're having that wishful thinking.
There was a shift. Courtney's frozen. What I failed to do in that moment, because I felt that as a gut punch. Courtney felt that as a gut punch. And then I just moved on. I should have stayed with it and developed that. Hold on. You just said something. You know, you just said something.
You just blew up your entire case. Could we talk about this and maybe take it back?
You know, why? What's that about? What, you know? Or dealt with it in a different way, because then his wife, you know, said the same thing when she was testifying. And we should have at that point said, okay, you know what? If Artemis and David were there, they would have pulled us aside and said, okay, we got to figure out a way to fix this over the next couple of days and turn this into a story that, you know, that the jurors can understand. But no, we didn't.
I have to admit, Artemis would have caught
marching that. Forward, and the jurors, you know, talking to him after the
verdict. Artemis would have caught it right away. I would have caught it that night.
No, but it is 2 a.m. You know,
my choke chain and said, "You caught it too, Courtney." Do you know what I mean? Like, that was one of those big ones where we do know better. And you can kind of get yourself swept into maybe hoping, well, shit, all the other facts are so good. And so it's exactly what David and Artemis are talking about, that one great fact does not mask some weird, you know, leper blister that's sitting there.
And also repeating
what did you say?
Things,
what was that phrase?
Leper blister. But also blister. Repeating things.
I've never heard that one before.
I'll have attorneys tell me in focus groups, especially when we're doing deliberation focus groups, or we're watching, go back in there and tell them this, remind them of this. And I'm like, that's not how jurors work. That's not how people work. People catch on to one thing, and if it fits the narrative that they want to have, if it's somehow, but wherever they're leaning, if it moves them in that direction, they hold on to it. And sometimes, you know, you're listening to them like, huh, I barely even said that. Like, it wasn't even it was glossed in a whole bunch of other stuff, but that's what they do. And it's a really important thing. So going back to length of trial and how long should it be and all that stuff, it needs to be enough to give them the information that they need, not stuff that they can do dangerous things with. What are all the dangerous things can they do with the information you must give them or the defense is going to give? And how can you put that into a context, into a way that makes sense for them, so at the end they can side with you and you've led them in that direction?
Well, you see, working here is right to that original question you all asked about how do we deal with disagreements? And Nick pointed out, right, that at base, we're not in disagreement. What we sometimes have different ways to do is to accomplish what we're all in disagreement and what we're all in agreement about. And I'm sure the four of us would come up with four different things that Nick should have done had he had a few hours to sleep on it. And that's the problem with being a trial lawyer. You've got to have your mind in a whole bunch of places at once, which good trial lawyers almost always do, but nobody is going to do it every single time, especially in trial when you're not that, you're tired. I mean, you're in trial. But I think what's happened in the book is if you look at the goals of every technique throughout the book, they are all consistent. It is how we tend to get there. And even then, you're not going to find that much disagreement, but we weren't trying to stay unified there. It's on the goals of where we're going. And that just turned out to be almost all unified. I don't think there's a place where I disagree with any of the other three folks in terms of the fundamental of where you're trying to get.
But I think what a book like this does is it lets you in on the conversation that maybe you don't have the time or the whatever, you're not in a place where you can pick up the phone and call Artemis and ask that question. But Nick and I call Rahul, you know, right? Like, this is what we all have to do because we are all practicing as islands and we forget that there are resources out there. And the book brings that right into your home, hopefully. I think that was the ultimate goal of all of us is, you know, you start thinking that you're the only one and you're not, and we're all doing this together. And so it's just an invitation into this circle. And that's what this podcast is. And that's what all of these like trial guides and all these, and it's so neat. I mean, what, 10 years ago, it was damages with a bunch of coffee stains and dog ears and good luck.
Well, what's nice now is Trial Guides has in fact started a listserv just focusing on this book. So that people who come to know this book now have a place to continue the book's discussion. That's why it's not called Damages, the Evolution, which is our original idea, which came from Nick, and it was a great idea, but rather Damages Evolving. And we went through all kinds of discussions about what the cover should be. And what we ended up with was this lovely cover, I think, that takes you farther, takes you into the future. Not just now, because that we want that book to be around and be useful for years. And I think both the cover and the book managed to accomplish that because it gives you tons of stuff you can do tomorrow. But it also gives you a way to think in terms of what we were talking about earlier is that the culture changes, the juries change, different people, different kinds of people are going to come in and they'll be sitting in front of you. How do you adjust your thinking so as to account for facts we can't predict? Artemis pointed out that we went through a period of very few months in which we had three or four huge changes in the culture, the nature of juries. And that could happen again tomorrow, given the state, just listening to the news this morning, whatever morning it is these days, the world could change again on us tomorrow, and you've got to go to trial on Thursday or Friday, and what in the world are you going to do? You can't refocus everything. You can't redo everything. You need to know how to adjust, and also to the jury you got. So that's
the book. We started this book, and we were close to finishing the book before the pandemic. And we had a deadline. And oh boy, when you have a deadline, if you don't have your shit done, David Ball is not happy. He's like, we need to get this done. And he's, you know, the hammer's coming down. You're getting emails. I'm like, oh my God.
I'm a different, I'm an old theater brat, remember? And the show must go on the night you advertised.
Yep. And then the pandemic happened. Then we all had a conversation, said, hold on, this is going to change things. And that's where it went from damages, the evolution, to damages evolving, because we saw how things were evolving. This recent case that we tried, the Simers versus LA Times case, is the perfect example of what we're trying to talk about in this book in a way that we're not happy about it. The way we tried the Simers case is the same way we tried it a couple of years ago. And the result was way different, with a way different jury. And I mean, with masks and I thought, you know, we've won this case before. I know how to win it. They got a new defense lawyer. And I'm telling you, that did not make a difference in this case. Bringing in a different defense lawyer didn't make a difference. In fact, the defense lawyer that was brought in, very good defense lawyer. Linda Sabbat was a very good defense lawyer. That should have resulted in a bigger verdict. But we tried the case the same way we did 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. That was our mistake. And you know, we did it under a crunch. So rather than really giving a lot of thought to how do we do this differently, and when we showed up to pick the jury, we were the only show in town, the largest courthouse in the country, more trial courts than any courthouse anywhere else in America, and we were the only jury trial. Of all the jurors called in, 17 showed up. So we had to pick a jury of 12 out of 17, and we had jurors on there that we would never keep. So rather than what we should have done was exercised our peremptories and got the case mistried. But our client wanted the case to go forward. He's 72. He's had and it's the third trial. He was upset that it got continued from December. We said, hey, we don't want to try, you know, the case in this climate, but we did it anyways. And we shouldn't have. So that's the first place where we went wrong, because we weren't thinking about the evolution and what's going on, you know, at that point in time and whether this case fits and how to present the case differently. We did it the same way that we did 2 years ago. Didn't work out the same way. That's a huge lesson.
Can everyone imagine how much more we would all know, all of us, about trials if more lawyers were secure enough to be able to talk about where they themselves could have done things better? But what we hear, we go to CLEs, is war stories about how wonderfully I did. And you sit in the back of the room and say, well, tell us about the case you didn't do. That's where we're going to learn from. You don't learn about planes that came back to the airbase successfully after the battle. You learn about what went wrong and the ones that didn't come back. It's a longer story that's actually a fun kind of puzzle for people. But it's true. I mean, we learn. Look at how much I don't know if everybody knows this, but the enormous amount we learned about safety from the Challenger disaster. Look at one of the reasons the world is as safe as it is because trial lawyers have probed into all the things that went wrong, for God's sake. That's the heart of our profession. That's why it's grim. And here the profession itself won't do it to itself. We don't do our own failure analysis. We do it privately, But if we shared, like we shared the good stuff, can you imagine how much we'd know? All our planes would come back safe.
Jerry Spence, who I love and who taught me so much, that I went in at the beginning of my career, having followed Jerry Spence since, you know, I was a kid in Iowa because he represented Randy Weaver, who was from my hometown, the Ruby Ridge case. So I never thought I'd be able to go to law school because I was such a delinquent, you know, but I served in the military as a medic and I got the, you know, had the GI Bill and I ended up going to law school. And then I get out to Spence's ranch within the first year and a half of practicing law. But he was America's most winningest trial lawyer. Never lost. That's how it was, you know, that's how people spoke of him. And that's what, you know, the words were on the book. And he had lost cases, you know, in his career, but those aren't the ones that he talked about. I learned so much from Jerry. I mean, it's in my DNA now. And I spread, you know, what I've learned from him. But there was only one time where he talked about a case that he lost. And I wanted to learn more. And the last trial that he did was in my home state of Iowa. I went to that trial. I made him his almond butter sandwiches. And, you know, I went to the trial in Michigan where he represented a lawyer who was being criminally prosecuted and he got Jeff Figer acquitted. It was, I mean, amazing to see Jerry Spence in trial. I've never seen anything like it. In the trial in Iowa, he was amazing, but he didn't win that case. The jurors came back his last trial and they read a defense verdict. And then when they polled the jury, three women said, no, we don't agree with this verdict. So you have to have a unanimous jury in federal court to win in a civil case. In other states, that would have been a defense verdict. But when they polled the jury, the case was mistried and they resolved the case after. I've never heard, and none of us had heard about what happened with that trial and what did you learn? And there are so many lawyers out there that are so successful and they don't talk about the losses. And that's a disservice to everyone, because the reason why these lawyers are so successful and so great is because they did learn from the cases that they lost. They went down and they went over it again and again and again, and they changed the way they do things. And that's what, I'm 44. Hopefully I have another, you know, 30 years of this ahead of me. I am going to lose cases. You can talk to me about the ones that I've won, but talk to me about the ones that I've lost and where I've gone wrong and what I've learned, you know, because it's going to happen, because I'm going to continue to try tough cases. And that's what we need from the leaders out there. I know Rahul, I know Brian Panish. They will talk about the cases that they've lost.
One of the great one of the great close friend of ours, this is Gary Johnson in Kentucky, who is almost in the habit of saying, the next thing I learned the hard way.
Yes.
Here's what happened, and that's the lesson I learned out of it. If those folks can do it.
The best way he says it, because I was thinking of Gary David at the time, because he says, the reason why I'm the attorney I am today, because I got my ass kicked here, bitten here. Like he's always like, he shows, well, he turns around and shows the ass. It's like, because of this and this.
He showed us the bruises on his back.
Absolutely.
I learned that from Rick Friedman. I've learned that from Keith Mitnick. I've learned that from Brian Panish. I've learned that from Gary Dordick and from you guys that, hey, okay, so you won. So you won a case. All right. What are you going to learn from that? Talk openly about the cases that you lost and don't be ashamed.
The principle is the reason airplanes are so safe to use these days, or the safest mode of travel, is because the failures were studied in detail and disseminated far and wide. So you're safer in an airplane than you are in an elevator, for God's sake. Don't mean to scare those of you who have to use an elevator every day, but you're safer in an airplane.
That's a good one.
I'll say that this last week of postmortem has been more creative, more awake, more alive than we have been in a while. And also darker, you know. But I don't know that it that any of it, that any of the beauty comes without that suffering, right? I mean, that's why is that inherent in all religious traditions?
When you don't do that, when you make excuses for what happened, you are going to do the same wrong things again. It's as simple as that.
Also, when you blame the jury, you say, "Oh, it's just a dumb jury." When you say that thing,
right?
First of all, that's letting yourself off the hook. So you're not learning anything, because if you're just going to say, "Oh, it was a bad jury," whatever. And the other thing that does is that it gets in your mind that the jury is the enemy. And that when you're going to your next trial, you're looking at those jurors as the enemy, and, "Oh, you're waiting to screw me, and who are the folks that I really hate," and all that stuff. So it sets up this whole mentality that is really, like, you know, devastating on down. It doesn't help you at all. So that's part of it. And also the other thing is, you know, Nick, you were sharing with us before we started, was another issue in your case was the wonderful, third side of the story, which is Google. What can they find on the internet? No matter how many times the judge says, "Do not go online, do not do that." And this is why I will do my, when I'm doing 2 day sessions that are longer than 4 hours, I will do them over a 2 day period, because I want the presentation on day one and come back on day two to deliver
with the same.
They have their own time to go online. I don't tell them to go online, but every time I will have a juror that comes back and discusses in deliberation what they found online. And that tells you they do that, of course.
They do that in real trials all the time. And the more the judge tells them not to, the more they do it.
What happened in Symers was the jurors went back and deliberated. Well, we finished closings on Friday. They came back Tuesday after Martin Luther King Day, and a few of the jurors said he already won money and got compensated in those other trials. And then the dollar amounts they were talking about, which were around $10 million, just shot right down. They said, "Really? What are we doing here then? We're spending our, you know, our vacation time, you know, all of our sick days to do this trial where he's already been compensated." And they were upset and enraged. So we have juror declarations on that. Maybe we'll have a fourth trial.
And, you know, if they had found that out, if they had happened to stumble on that at the beginning, you could have lost the case altogether.
There were jurors that wanted to get $50,000. In fact, the way the numbers went down, the juror said, "Give him $50,000. He's already been compensated."
And if they started with that attitude, they would barely have listened to your case.
Yep. So there's textbooks.
But listen, Nick, going along with what you said, we rolled out of Christmas into this case. There was a lot of pressure for it to happen, even though we knew, and it felt weird. It didn't feel like right. And so we fell back on, okay, this is how we know how to do it. And if you don't remember, the second trial, we did call Artemis.
We did.
One phone call to Artemis, and Artemis would have said, "Wow, what about all that 15 mil, 10 mil, 7 mil shit flying around on the internet, Courtney? Have you thought about that?" That would have been a 6-minute conversation. Well, aside from all the backstory and the gossip, which would have been way nice.
All we had to tell the jury was, "Folks, Mr. Symers hasn't received a penny of compensation over 9 years in the prior two trials." That would have been okay to say.
Yeah.
The jurors needed that. I'm afraid of this trial that I start on Monday. It's going to be televised through CVN. They're going to broadcast it. It's a medical malpractice case in Kalispell, Montana, where no one's ever won a medical malpractice verdict, where there's never been a big jury verdict. And we have a 17-year-old who was blind because of medical negligence. We're against the largest employer, you know, in the community, Kalispell Regional Medical Center. And they're offering nothing. And I'm scared. I mean, when I go to trial, when I'm there, I'm not going to be, you know, I won't be scared in that moment. But right now, thinking I'm going into a tough case, a medical negligence case against some really good lawyers. And they've got all the top experts making excuses and saying these doctors did nothing wrong. If I win that case.
And babe, how much does that last week weigh on you?
A lot.
Does that play into how you're feeling now?
Absolutely. It does. So I am, you know, I will go into this case differently. If I had just got the verdict I wanted on the Symers worst case, I'd be going in there half cocked, right? Hey, I haven't had a disappointing verdict in, you know, over 6 years. So I'm going to walk in just, you know, clean house with these guys. So, you know, you need to be humbled every once in a while.
Because we don't get our heroes out of easy conditions. You know, you have to have the crap thrown at you, and that's what separates what used to be able to say the men from the boys or whatever it was, or the boys from the girls or whatever the hell the phrase was, that will now get you in trouble no matter how you put it. What do you do when you're feeling like that? Are you up to it? And that's the measure. And even then, this is ultimately a crapshoot, finally. And you've got to throw the best dice you can possibly throw and not give in to that. It's so easy for me to say. It's why I don't do what y'all do. I didn't do it in theater either. I would tell the actors what to do, and they got on the stage and did it. If they did it beautifully, I said, well, they did what I told them to do, so it came out wonderfully. And if the show fails, I said, well, you can't be up there with them. They didn't do everything I told them. I'm in the easy position. It's you folks that are sweating the bullets. Well,
this has been a fascinating conversation. I could just sit back and listen for a long time, and we've been pushing up.
It's too early for popcorn. Otherwise, I would have had it the whole time. This was
really
fantastic.
Great. And Nick, I hope you'll have a great result and come back and tell us about it. Or if you don't, you'll come back and autopsy it with us after your next trial. And so why don't we call it a day? But thanks so much for coming on and doing this with us. We really appreciate everything you guys have done to teach trial lawyers across the country and improve the craft. One last thing. Where can folks find the book, and when is it available?
Trial Guides is taking pre-orders now, finally. You can also sign up for that little listserv, which people are actually doing, and it's already being kind of interesting. That's, you know, within a day or two of it opening. But Trial Guides at trialguides.com, or you can call them or however you offer order books there. And hopefully it'll be out. We're supposed to be out on the 1st of January, but, you know, like everything else, I don't think there's any paper left in the world because of the supply chain problems, but they're saying February, early February to mid-February, but we'll see.
Awesome.
Thanks again.
Can I throw one more? Can I throw a plug? If anybody listening could get on fairnessact.com, that's fairnessact.com, the Fairness for Injured Patients Act. We're working hard to change California's 1975 one-size-fits-all $250,000 cap on quality of life damages and the value of lives of children and retirees and stay-at-home parents who are negligently killed by malpractice. We've got to raise, you know, $20-30 million, and we're going to do it, but we can't do it without your help. So please get on and learn and spread the word. And, you know, whether it's $5 or $20 or $1 million, please do all that you can. Because if we win this, that California is the root of where caps on damages started. And if we can kill this at its root, then we can change it in other states too, which we have done so successfully. So we need everybody to erase your state lines and get involved. Please, please help.
Thank you, folks, for having us. This was fun.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Bye, you guys.
Bye.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.